Chapter 6. The troops were under arms and formed in battalion. After the passage of the procession, the garden was again open to the public. And the evening and the morning were the first day. There's nothing serious in mortality. Is there, from the beginning of this account to the end thereof, aught but sheer, open, monstrous, undisguised humbug? I said, before, that you should have a history of these people by Dickens or Theodore Hook, but there is little need of professed wax. Do not the men write their own tale with an admirable Sancho-like gravity and naivety, which one could not desire improved? How good is that touch of sly indignation about the little catafalques? How rich the contrast presented by the economy of the Catholics to the splendid disregard of expense exhibited by the devout Jews? And how touching the apologetical discourses on the revolution, delivered by the Protestant pastors? Fancy the profound affliction of the guards municipaux, the surgeons de ville, the police agents in plain clothes, and the troops with fixed bayonets, sobbing round the expiatory monuments of a pyramidical shape, surmounted by funeral vases, and compelled, by sad duty, to fire into the public who might wish to indulge in the same woe. O Ains of July! The phrase is pretty and grammatical. Why did you with sharp bullets break those Louvre windows? Why did you bayonet red-coated Swiss behind that fair white facade, and, braving cannon, musket, saber, perspective guillotine, burst yonder bronze gates, rush through that peaceful picture gallery, and hurl royalty, loyalty, and a thousand years of kings, head over heels out of yonder Tuileries windows? It is, you will allow, a little difficult to say. There is, however, one benefit that the country has gained.
As for liberty of press, or person, diminished taxation, a juster representation, whoever thinks of them.
One benefit they have gained, or nearly abolition de la peine de mort pour délit politique. No more wicked guillotining for revolutions. A Frenchman must have his revolution. It is his nature to knock down omnibuses in the street, and across them to fire at troops of the line. It is a sin to balk it. Did not the king send off revolutionary Prince Napoleon in a coach and four? Did not the jury, before the face of God and justice, proclaim revolutionary Colonel Vaudrey not guilty? One may hope, soon, that if a man shows decent courage and energy in half a dozen emeutes, he will get promotion and a premium. I do not,
although, perhaps, partial to the subject,
want to talk more nonsense than the occasion warrants, and will pray you to cast your eyes over the following anecdote that is now going the round of the papers, and respects the commutation of the punishment of that wretched, foolhardy Barbs, who, on his trial, seemed to invite the penalty which has just been remitted to him. You recollect the braggart's speech: colon, when the Indian falls into the power of the enemy, he knows the fate that awaits him, and submits his head to the knife. I am the Indian. Well, M. Hugo was at the opera on the night the sentence of the Court of Peers, condemning Barbes to death, was published. The great poet composed the following verses. Par vader ancien voli, ains I qu'un column, par le royal infant, doux et frile rasso, grace encore une fois. Grace au nom de la tombe. Grace au nom du berceau. Apostrophe asterisk, M. Victor Hugo wrote the lines out instantly on a sheet of paper, which he folded, and simply dispatched them to the King of the French by the penny post. That truly is a noble voice, which can at all hours thus speak to the throne. Poetry, in old days, was called the language of the gods. It is better named now. It is the language of the kings. But the clemency of the king had anticipated the letter of the poet. His majesty had signed the commutation of Barbes while the poet was still writing. Louis Philippe replied to the author of Riblas most graciously that he had already subscribed to a wish so noble, and that the verses had only confirmed his previous disposition to mercy. Asterisk translated for the benefit of country gentlemen. Why your angel flown away just like a dove, by the royal infant, that frail and tender reed, pardon yet once more.
Pardon in the name of the tomb. Pardon in the name of the cradle. Now in countries where fools most abound, did one ever read of more monstrous, palpable folly? In any country, save this, would a poet who chose to write four crack-brained verses, comparing an angel to a dove, and a little boy to a reed, and calling upon the chief magistrate, in the name of the angel, or dove, the Princess Mary, in her tomb, and the little infant in his cradle, to spare a criminal, have received a gracious answer to his nonsense? Would he have ever dispatched the nonsense? And would any journalist have been silly enough to talk of the noble voice that could thus speak to the throne, and the noble throne that could return such a noble answer to the noble voice? You get nothing done here gravely and decently. Tawdry stage tricks are played, and braggadocio claptraps uttered, on every occasion, however sacred or solemn. In the face of death, as by Barbes with his hideous Indian metaphor. In the teeth of reason, as by M. Victor Hugo with his twopenny post-poetry, and of justice, as by the king's absurd reply to this absurd demand. Suppose the Count of Paris, to be 20 times a reed, and the Princess Mary a host of angels, is that any reason why the law should not have its course? Justice is the god of our lower world, our great omnipresent guardian. As such it moves, or should move on majestic, awful, irresistible, having no passions like a god. But, in the very midst of the path across which it is to pass, lo, M. Victor Hugo trips forward, smirking, and says, O divine justice, I will trouble you to listen to the following trifling effusion of mine. Par vader angen voli, ains I cune, and see, awful justice stops, and, bowing gravely, listens to M. Hugo's verses, and, with true French politeness, says, Mon cher monsieur, these verses are charming, ravissons, délicieux, and, coming from such a celebrate litterer as yourself, shall meet with every possible attention. In fact, had I required anything to confirm my own previous opinions, this charming poem would have done so. Bonjour, mon cher monsieur Hugo, au revoir. And they part. Justice taking off his hat and bowing, and the author of I Blas quite convinced that he has been treating with him Degel and Egel. I can hardly bring my mind to fancy that anything is serious in France. It seems to be all rant, tinsel, and stage play. Sham liberty, sham monarchy, sham glory, sham justice, ou diable dans la verite va-t-il si nature? The last rocket of the fate of July has just mounted, exploded, made a portentous bang, and emitted a gorgeous show of blue lights, and then, like many reputations, disappeared totally. The 100th gun on the invalid terrace has uttered its last roar, and a great comfort it is for eyes and ears that the festival is over. We shall be able to go about our everyday business again, and not be hustled by the gendarmes or the crowd. The sight which I have just come away from is as brilliant, happy, and beautiful as can be conceived. And if you want to see French people to the greatest advantage, you should go to a festival like this, where their manners and innocent gaiety show a very pleasing contrast to the coarse and vulgar hilarity which the same class would exhibit in our own country at Epsom Racecourse, for instance, or Greenwich Fair. The greatest noise that I heard was that of a company of jolly villagers from a place in the neighborhood of Paris, who, as soon as the fireworks were over, formed themselves into a line, three or four abreast, and so marched singing home. As for the fireworks, squibs and crackers are very hard to describe, and very little was to be seen of them. To me, the prettiest sight was the vast, orderly, happy crowd, the number of children, and the extraordinary care and kindness of the parents towards these little creatures. It does one good to see honest heavy épiciers, fathers of families, playing with them in the Tuileries, or, as tonight, bearing them stoutly on their shoulders, through many long hours, in order that the little ones too may have their share of the fun. John Bull, I fear, is more selfish. He does not take Mrs. Bull to the public house, but leaves her, for the most part, to take care of the children at home. The fate, then, is over. The pompous black pyramid at the Louvre is only a skeleton now. All the flags have been miraculously whisked away during the night, and the fine chandeliers which glittered down the Champs-Élysées for full half a mile have been consigned to their dens and darkness. Will they ever be reproduced for other celebrations of the glorious 29th of July? I think not. The government which vowed that there should be no more persecutions of the press was, on that very 29th, seizing a legitimist paper for some real or fancied offense against it. It had seized, and was seizing daily, numbers of persons merely suspected of being disaffected.
And you may fancy how liberty is understood when some of these prisoners, the other day, on coming to trial, were found guilty and sentenced to one day's imprisonment, after 36 days' detention on suspicion.
I think the government which follows such a system cannot be very anxious about any farther revolutionary fates, and that the chamber may reasonably refuse to vote more money for them. Why should men be so mighty proud of having, on a certain day, cut a certain number of their fellow countrymen's throats? The guards and the line employed this time 9 years did no more than those who cannonaded the starving Lyonnese, or bayoneted the luckless inhabitants of the Rue Transnonain. They did but fulfill the soldier's honorable duty. His superiors bid him kill and he killeth. Perhaps, had he gone to his work with a little more heart, the result would have been different, and then would the conquering party have been justified in annually rejoicing over the conquered? Would we have thought Charles X justified in causing fireworks to be blazed, and concerts to be sung, and speeches to be spouted, in commemoration of his victory over his slaughtered countrymen? I wish for my part they would allow the people to go about their business, as on the other 362 days of the year, and leave the Champs-Élysées free for the omnibuses to run, and the Tuileries in quiet, so that the nursemaids might come as usual, and the newspapers be read for a halfpenny apiece. Shall I trouble you with an account of the speculations of these latter, and the state of the parties which they represent? The complication is not a little curious, and may form, perhaps, a subject of graver disquisition. The July fates occupy, as you may imagine, a considerable part of their columns just now, and it is amusing to follow them one by one, to read Tweedledum's praise, and Tweedledee's indignation, to read, in the debates, how the king was received with shouts and loyal vivats in the nation, how not a tongue was wagged in his praise, but, on the instant of his departure, how the people called for the Arsalas and applauded that. But best say no more about the fate. The legitimists were always indignant at it. The high Philippist party sneers at and despises it. The Republicans hate it. It seems a joke against them. Why continue it? If there be anything sacred in the name and idea of loyalty, why renew this fate? It only shows how a rightful monarch was hurled from his throne, and a dexterous usurper stole his precious diadem. If there be anything noble in the memory of a day when citizens, unused to war, rose against practiced veterans, and, armed with the strength of their cause, overthrew them, why speak of it now, or renew the bitter recollections of the bootless struggle and victory? O Lafayette! O hero of two worlds! O accomplished Cromwell Grandison! You have to answer for more than any mortal man who has played a part in history. Two republics and one monarchy does the world owe to you, and especially grateful should your country be to you. Did you not, in 90, make clear the path for honest Robespierre, and in 30 prepare the way for The editor of the Bungay Beacon would insert no more of this letter, which is, therefore, forever lost to the public. On the French School of Painting. With appropriate anecdotes, illustrations, and philosophical disquisitions. In a letter to Mr. McGilp, of London. The three collections of pictures at the Louvre, the Luxembourg, and the École des Beaux-Arts, contain a number of specimens of French art, since its commencement almost, and give the stranger a pretty fair opportunity to study and appreciate the school. The French list of painters contains some very good names, no very great ones, except Poussin,
unless the admirers of Claude choose to rank him among great painters,
and I think the school was never in so flourishing a condition as it is at the present day. They say there are 3,000 artists in this town alone. Of these, a handsome minority paint not merely tolerably, but well understand their business. Draw the figure accurately, sketch with cleverness, and paint portraits, churches, or restaurateurs' shops in a decent manner. To account for a superiority over England which, I think, as regards art, is incontestable, it must be remembered that the painter's trade in France is a very good one, better appreciated, better understood, and, generally, far better paid than with us. There are a dozen excellent schools which a lad may enter here, and, under the eye of a practiced master, learn the apprenticeship of his art at an expense of about £10 a year. In England there is no school except the academy, unless the student can afford to pay a very large sum, and place himself under the tuition of some particular artist. Here, a young man, for his £10, has all sorts of accessory instruction, models, and has further, and for nothing, numberless incitements to study his profession which are not to be found in England. The streets are filled with picture shops, the people themselves are pictures walking about, the churches, theaters, eating houses, concert rooms are covered with pictures. Nature itself is inclined more kindly to him, for the sky is 1,000 times more bright and beautiful, and the sun shines for the greater part of the year. Add to this, incitements more selfish, but quite as powerful. A French artist is paid very handsomely, for 500 a year is much where all are poor, and has a rank in society rather above his merits than below them, being caressed by hosts and hostesses in places where titles are laughed at and a baron is thought of no more account than a banker's clerk. The life of the young artist here is the easiest, merriest, dirtiest existence possible. He comes to Paris, probably at 16, from his province. His parents settle £40 a year on him, and pay his master. He establishes himself in the Pays Latin, or in the new quarter of Notre Dame de Lorette, which is quite peopled with painters. He arrives at his 8th lire at a tolerably early hour, and labors among a score of companions as merry and poor as himself. Each gentleman has his favorite tobacco pipe, and the pictures are painted in the midst of a cloud of smoke, and a din of puns and choice French slang, and a roar of choruses, of which no one can form an idea who has not been present. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.